Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, a special feature to mark Remembrance Day. A century on from the outbreak of the First World War, we speak to Professor John Pollard, an historian who has a particular expertise on the Pope of that wartime era. Spotlight on the preparatory document for next year's Synod of Bishops on the Family. That's with Bishop John Hine, head of the Committee for Marriage and Family Life of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. But first, as always, at this time of week, we bring you a report on the weekly general audience of Pope Francis with pilgrims from across the world. For this, we join Lydia O'Kane.
In his continuing catechesis on the Creed, Pope Francis turned his attention again this week to the communion of saints, which he said was a communion not only of persons, but also of spiritual goods. Through our sharing in these goods, the Pope continued, we grow in communion with Christ and with the Church. He then focused on what he called these three spiritual treasures, the sacraments, charisms, and charity.
In particular, consideramo i sacramenti, i carismi, e la carità.
In the sacraments, the Pope explained, we encounter Christ in all his saving power. We are confirmed in the joy of faith and sent forth to share with others the joy of salvation. In off-the-cuff remarks in Italian, the Holy Father also underlined how important it is to take communion and the importance of baptizing children early, because he said, this is the presence of Jesus Christ in us, who helps us. The Holy Father, continuing on this theme, went on to stress how vital it is we go to confession. He also added we should not be afraid of the priest scolding us, because it is Jesus we meet in the sacrament of reconciliation, and he forgives us.
Gesù che ti perdona.
Focusing on the second spiritual treasure, charisms, Pope Francis said that through the variety of charisms, the spiritual gifts and graces bestowed by the Holy Spirit, we help to build up the Church in unity, holiness and service. Then, moving on to the third spiritual treasure, charity, the Pope said that those who do not have this virtue do not serve the Church.
Se non le ha, non serve alla Chiesa.
On the subject of charity, the Holy Father, speaking in Italian, asked the faithful in St. Peter's Square to pray as an act of goodwill for a little girl aged 1.5 who he met before the audience. The Pope told them she was very sick. Let us pray, he said, for this beautiful little girl. In his concluding remarks, Pope Francis said, we are here for one another. The Church cannot grow if people are detached, cold and bad-humoured. The Church, he added, can only grow through love. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
And while our thanks there go to Lydia O'Kane for bringing us this report, what I'm about to do now is join Susie Hodges, who, as I mentioned a moment ago, speaks to Bishop John Hine, head of the Committee for Marriage and Family Life of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales, about a document formally released at a news conference in the Vatican last Tuesday, one which relates to the forthcoming October Extraordinary Synod of Bishops, which will run from the 5th to the 19th of October, and which will have as theme the pastoral challenges to the family in the context of evangelization. The document gives an overview of Church teaching on the family and spells out the many daunting challenges facing the family in today's society, saying there's an urgency for the Church to address these challenges. The document also includes a questionnaire or consultation containing 39 questions on family issues that has been sent to bishops' conferences around the world, asking them to share it as widely as possible so that input from local sources can be received. But why don't we listen to Susie Hodges' interview with Bishop Hine, which begins with his reaction to the Church's decision to send out this questionnaire and the feedback he's received so far from lay Catholics. Stay tuned.
I think it's extremely significant. I think it really responds to the desire for people, the laity and the Church, to be consulted on matters which concern them so deeply. My understanding, just in the recent times since it's been announced there was this consultation, is that couples are delighted that they're going to be involved in the consultation. I think it will make all the difference in the world to them, and I presume, you know, I hope, to the actual synod in the end.
The synod's theme talks about the pastoral challenges of the family, and in its preparatory document, it doesn't beat about the bush, does it, in listing those challenges and difficulties facing the family nowadays. What do you personally see as the most pressing of these issues? I know that you could be argued they're all pressing, but presumably some you might see as more pressing than others.
Yes, it's very refreshing that they are facing the real challenges so openly, and I think this in itself is of huge pastoral benefit, to know that these things are really going to be truly discussed, and that the synod, I'm sure, will be looking for pastoral approaches to meet these challenges. Which is the most significant one? I think, in some ways, things like marriage preparation, and I would go further than that, marriage enrichment afterwards, becoming part of the provision that dioceses and parishes provide for married couples. I think that's probably the most important issue we're facing, because in the end, all that we say about marriage, particularly marriage as a sacrament, does depend so vitally on that relationship between the couple themselves, and it is the foundation, really, of the family, that relationship that the couple, the father and the mother, have between themselves. That's where the love is lived most of all, first of all, and which is the sort of real basis for family life.
You talked about raising expectations, and of course we've seen in the press a lot of speculation as to whether there may be changes concerning church teaching after this synod, particularly when it comes to issues like church teaching towards separated, divorced or remarried couples who cannot presently receive communion. Do you think these expectations are perhaps going over the top or what?
Well, I think they are the reality that we're facing, and I'm so delighted that we're not completely dodging it. I do think also that we have to put that in context. You know, the church has 2,000 years of reflecting on the gospel teaching, and therefore the teaching is not likely to be changed all of a sudden and radically. But I do think that we need to understand it and to see what pastoral strategies we can employ to meet the real situation of married couples and families in our society today. Because really, I suppose, so much of it has been rather swept under the bed and forgotten about. Bringing it out into the light, I think, is the main thing. Once you do that, then you can begin to really look at possible strategies.
You mentioned that already there's been some quite enthusiastic feedback to this consultation ahead of the synod. Are you indeed expecting that a lot of lay Catholics will take up this invitation to provide their input?
I think quite a number will. I mean, the proportion of responses from the Catholic community, wouldn't like to predict exactly, but I do know already that a good many couples I've spoken to about it have said that they really do want to get involved. They're interested in the questions. They start asking you what some of the questions mean. And I always say to them, well, look, the great thing is for you to look at the questions you understand and which most affect your life and try and approach those first of all, and not think that you have to answer everything that's listed there in the question.
Looking at the wider issue of the Synod of Bishops on the family, what are you hoping that you will get out of it and what will eventually emerge from it?
I really hope that it will energize our whole approach to evangelization in a way, because as it says clearly in Gaudium et Spes, the family is the foundation of society, and it's the point at which human needs are so clear and real as part of people's experience. And I think it's when we touch together on those human needs, which are common to all in some way or another, that's when we begin to really communicate and be able to change people's approach and their way of thinking. And so that's really my hope. It'll be more as the basis for putting the family right at the center of our ministry, where it belongs.
You were listening there to Bishop John Hine, head of the Committee for Marriage and Family Life of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. He was speaking there to Susie Hodges. Our thanks go to both of them. The 11th of November. That's the day many nations mark Remembrance Day, as a way to pay tribute to the memory of those who have died and indeed are still dying on the battlefield across the world. As we know, the choice of this date goes back to 1918, when the armistice, which brought an end to the hostilities of the First World War, was signed at the 11th hour of the 11th month. Although, as we know too, the war officially ended with the signing of the Treaty of Versailles in France on the 28th of June 1919. It's a day which inspired the so-called Remembrance Poppy, an emblem recalling the poppies which grew over the graves of fallen soldiers, and inspired by John McCrae's poem In Flanders Fields. At any rate, as commemorations are beginning to take place across Europe to mark a century this coming August since the outbreak of that First World War, I'd like to bring you an interview focusing on the figure of the man who was Pope at the time of this war, Benedict XV. Before I do this, I'd like you to listen to some excerpts from this early 20th century Pope's encyclical, dated November 1st, 1914, Beatissimi Apostolorum, in which, as you'll discover in a moment, this Roman pontiff, born Giacomo della Chiesa, appeals for peace.
We implored kings and rulers to consider the floods of tears and of blood already poured out, and to hasten to restore to the nations the blessings of peace. All must combine to bringing Christian principles into honor, if we have any real desire for peace and harmony of human society.
But as my historian is about to highlight, Benedict XV didn't limit himself to writing encyclicals. He's Professor John Pollard, a well-known author, who once wrote a book by the title of The Unknown Pope, Benedict XV and the Pursuit of Peace. A title which, in a sense, shed the unknown pope part to it when Benedict XVI, now Pope Emeritus, was elected. For when Cardinal Ratzinger chose the name Benedict, he told us he'd done so inspired not just by Saint Benedict, but also by Benedict XV. This is what he said, quote,
"Ho voluto chiamarmi Benedetto.
I wanted to be called Benedict XVI in order to create a spiritual bond with Benedict XV, who steered the Church through the period of turmoil caused by the First World War. He was a true and courageous prophet of peace who struggled strenuously and bravely first to avoid the drama of war and then to limit its terrible consequences."
An opinion this which seems to be shared by Professor Pollard.
Benedict XV tried to stop the First World War. Quite an extraordinary thing to do, but he did. You know, in his peace note of August 1917, he condemned a war of useless slaughter, which, as you can imagine, did not go down very well in certain Allied and German-Austrian circles. It was a note to the powers.
Speak more about that note.
He had sent Pacelli, Eugenio Pacelli, to Germany.
The cardinal and future pope.
To prepare the ground with the Germans. And then he issued the peace note, which wasn't just simply the usual sort of pious plea to please stop the war. It actually set out a list of issues on which they could negotiate. The evacuation of Belgium, resolution of problems over access to the seas, and so on and so forth. In that sense, it was
very
a practical
pragmatic
thing. It was a practical thing. It wasn't just a pious appeal.
And did he operate at all at a humanitarian level?
He was the first pope who really engaged in that, and indeed Eugenio Pacelli, as Pius XII during the Second World War, very much followed the example, the model which Benedict had set. I mean, Benedict, you know, created this office which received letters from prisoner of war families or from families of soldiers who were missing and tried to trace them. He also tried to get young, injured soldiers, prisoners of war and sick ones to be taken to Switzerland so that they could be given better health treatment. It was quite a substantial undertaking.
But do you think there was an awareness of what was going on in the trenches?
That was another thing which Benedict did. Was he was really horrified by the new methods of warfare.
Which were gas.
Gas, but also submarine warfare and also aerial bombardment. In particular, the aerial bombardment of civilian populations began in the First World War, which reached its appalling culmination in the Second. But he protested on several occasions against the use of these kinds of methods of warfare.
Now, before we get back to our historian, Professor Pollard, I'd like you to listen to another excerpt from Benedict XV's Beatissimi Apostolorum, relating this time to modern warfare.
Well provided with the most awful weapons modern military science has devised, they strive to destroy one another with refinements of horror. There is no limit to the measure of ruin and of slaughter. Day by day, the earth is drenched with newly shed blood and is covered with the bodies of the wounded and of the slain. The furious battle is engaged. The sad cohorts of war, sorrow, and distress swoop down upon every city and every home.
The centenary commemorations of the First World War provide us with an opportunity to better get to know Benedict XV. So why don't you join me as I step back in time once again with Professor Pollard in an effort to discover more about this Pope who was elected in September of 1914. Be sure to listen on as we begin by speaking of Pius X, since canonized saint, who was Pope at the outbreak of the Second World War. Pope Pius X was elected to the papacy in 1903, and he died in 1914. He died on 20th of August, and it's said that he died of a broken heart because of the war.
Well, we can't prove that scientifically, but certainly he was horrified by the outbreak of the war.
Is it true that he said, "I bless peace, I don't bless war"?
He did. I think he actually said that to the Austro-Hungarians.
It was a particular situation at that time, wasn't it? I mean, Pius X was elected also thanks to the Austrian-Hungarian vote, wasn't he?
Yes, because the Austro-Hungarians in 1903 blocked the election of Rampolla del Tindaro, who was the Secretary of State of the previous Pope, Leo XIII.
And Pius X eliminated that privilege, didn't he, right away, as soon as he became Pope?
He did. He put the thing straight, yes.
But he also had some very specific ideas as regards the powers of the time and his dealings, for example, with France, didn't he?
Yes, he inherited a very difficult situation with France because the Republican anti-clericals had come to power and they fell out with the church, with the Vatican, and eventually carried out a separation of church and state in France. They effectively disinherited the church, removed all its property. And then there was a breakdown of diplomatic relations between France and the Vatican. So it was a pretty difficult situation.
There was no representative of the French nation to the Vatican at the time.
Nor of the Pope in Paris. But I think the situation was much worse than that, because the papal diplomacy of Pius X and also of his Secretary of State, Cardinal Merry del Val, was very intransigent, so that in 1914 the Vatican had very limited diplomatic relations with the powers. It was only with Russia, with Germany and with Austria-Hungary. They didn't have relations with the British or the Americans either.
So just to clarify, the Triple Entente was on the one hand Britain, France and Russia, no?
Yes.
And on the other side, we had
Austria-Hungary and Germany.
And Germany. It must have been a difficult situation. Could Pius X have done more to prevent the war, do you think? What tools did he have? Did the Pope have any influence in the international scenario, do you think, at that particular time?
I don't think so. I mean, there's been some controversy about this, but I don't think he had any. Vatican diplomacy was really at its nadir in 1914. And that was the problem that faced Benedict XV, who was a diplomat to his fingertips, even though he'd been Bishop of Bologna for 6 or 7 years. And his job was to try and rebuild the network of relationships, diplomatic relationships, which the Vatican had previously possessed.
Basically, when the war began, the church was leaderless. And then, as you say, Benedict XV was elected Pope. At the beginning of September 1914, then. What kind of an impact did the fact that he was a diplomat have on the international situation? Did he have any clout?
Initially, very little impact, because remember, he'd been Archbishop of Bologna since 1908, so he'd been out of the giro diplomatico for quite a long time. The thing that really changed the Vatican's diplomatic position was the war itself, and was the fact that the British, first of all, realised that they were vis-à-vis the Vatican in a very inferior position because they had no representation in the Vatican, whereas the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians had representation. The Russians were not treated very seriously by the Vatican anyway. So the Entente powers, Britain, France and Russia, and countries like Belgium had to rebuild relationships with the Vatican.
At the time of the war, there were people like Hilaire Belloc in Rome, no? He was Times correspondent. I know that he, for example, was received in audience by Benedict XVI. But what about other journalists of the time? I mean, were they interested in the Vatican at all and what was going on there? Or anyway, how can one know what was happening in the Vatican at the time? Can you enlighten me in any way?
There is the story of Cardinal Aidan Gasquet, who was an English Benedictine, who ended up in the Roman Curia, and who was horrified by the amount of influence which the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians exercised inside the Vatican. And he tried very hard to break this.
Benedict XV wrote various encyclicals focusing on peace, no? His first was in 1914, on the 1st of November 1914. If you read that encyclical today, the language is very old-fashioned, isn't it? But actually the content is very similar to what you would write today, isn't it?
Well, yes, except that, of course, you know, we're looking at the Church, the papacy, at a time when it firmly believed that it was the victim of a great conspiracy, of Freemasonry, secularists, liberals, and so on. So Benedict described the causes of the war very much to materialism, to secularism, to liberalism, rather than seeing it specifically as the result of a series of conflicts, economic, political, geopolitical, whatever. But what's interesting, I think, is that he immediately understood the nature of the conflict. He realized that there was a real racial element to the conflict. There was a kind of social Darwinian element to it. And of course, he was proved right, because it was seen by many in Germany, for example, as a sort of final conflict between the Germans, the Teutonic race, and the Slavs, the Russians. And he got that very quickly.
It was a racial element in there.
It was a racial element, yes. Yes.
One never talks about that.
Well, not very much, but it's evident to me at any rate.
You talked about the effects of the war. It kind of threw the Vatican at centre stage, in a sense, or didn't it?
I wouldn't say centre stage, but it certainly pushed it further towards the centre, because every side wanted its moral support. And indeed, if you look at the Vatican archives in this period, they bulge with red, green, blue, white books about the atrocities of each side, sent in, of course, by the two sides, trying to get the Vatican to commit itself, trying to get the Vatican to condemn the activities, the war activities, of one power against another power. And the Vatican had huge difficulties trying to steer through this, because obviously what Benedict and his Secretary of State, Pietro Gasparri, were trying to do was to maintain a position of neutrality and impartiality.
Difficult during a war?
Very difficult, particularly when they had their own war aims.
You say they had their own war aims?
Yes, they had their own war aims. I mean, fundamentally, what the Vatican was committed to was preserving the status quo, ante bellum, because that preserved the balance of power between, on the one hand, Catholic Austria-Hungary and Germany, which was essentially under Protestant Prussian control, but also between Catholic Austria-Hungary and Russia, which, of course, was the Orthodox state. And there was a certain paranoia in the Vatican throughout the whole period of totalitarianism, by the way, right the way down to after the Second World War, about the threat of Orthodoxy.
How did the Pope communicate with the various powers of the time in those days? I mean, we didn't have telephones or things like that. Diplomats had a big role.
Yes, I mean, they had to telegraph, and eventually, after the British re-established relations in 1914, they re-established relations very quickly. And then the French sent an unofficial embassy to the Vatican, because they realised the importance, you know, of, as it were, the Catholic vote. They essentially communicated through their representatives or by letter, so that diplomatic documents were issued and distributed to the powers, even those powers with whom the Vatican did not have diplomatic relations. So that, for example, the Vatican had communications with President Wilson's United States of America in 1917. They tried very hard to persuade the Americans not to enter the war in 1917, just as it had tried to persuade the Italians not to enter the war in May 1915.
It was not very successful.
It was not very successful. Mm-hmm. The Italian case is very interesting, because there was a channel of backstairs communication. One of Benedict XV's friends, Carlo Monti, who was a high functionary in the Ministry of Justice, acted as a sort of
go-between
the Italian government and the Vatican, and he probably prevented serious rows between the Vatican and the Italian government during the course of the war.
So he did have a role. I know that for your book on Benedict XV, the De La Chiesa family, to which Benedict the 15th belonged to, opened their archives for you.
They did indeed. They were very kind to me.
What did you discover about Benedict the 15th?
The real value of the material which the Della Chiesa family allowed me to have a look at was how much light it shed on him as a young man, as a boy, as a young man, and also his experience of Vatican diplomacy, because he worked in the Madrid Nunciature in the, I think, the 1880s. And then of his experience, this was crucial, his experience in Bologna as Archbishop of Bologna. I mean, well, you have to understand, Benedict XV wasn't just a diplomat. He was a pastoral pope. I mean, he really got his hands dirty. I mean, Bologna was one of the most difficult places to be Archbishop of just before the First World War.
Why was that?
Because eventually it became Bologna La Rossa. It became the very heartland of the Red Belt in Italy. And it was very clear already that the Italian working class movement, which was of a Marxist socialist stripe, was making huge inroads amongst the working classes and also amongst the peasantry in the province of Bologna. So he really was faced by the serious problems of the early 20th century.
So reading his papers, what sense did you get personally of this 20th century pope?
On the one hand, I got the sense that he was pious, I mean, that he had a real spiritual life, as you would hopefully expect. He truly did that. He was very devoted. He was very well organized. He was amazingly efficient. You know, he ran the Diocese of Bologna like a tight ship. I mean, it was very clear about this. He was very pragmatic, very hands-on. I mean, he understood money. That was another thing.
He knew. Well, he was from Genoa.
He was from Genoa, yes, exactly.
Genoese have a reputation
like
the
Scots. What do you expect? Yes, no, no. He was also a man of great ideals. I mean, on the one hand, he stuck to, you know, the teachings of the Church, the teachings of Pius X. But on the other hand, he was aware of the gravity of the social problems that faced parts of northern and central Italy.
At the time of his pontificate, the Concordat hadn't been signed, no? What did that entail? Because the Pope was a prisoner of his own will in the Vatican, no, at the time.
Well, it caused all sorts of practical difficulties for the Pope and for the Roman Curia, because, as you know, the Pope could, well, you say he's a prisoner of the Vatican, he could not leave the Vatican, so that meant he couldn't even go to his own cathedral, to St. John Lateran, to be enthroned. He couldn't visit Roman parishes, as, of course, popes have done since 1929. And there were all sorts of problems. For example, a very simple one. One point during the war, Carlo Monti, his friend, had to intercede with the Italian government to prevent prelates in the Roman Curia, like, for example, Eugenio Pacelli, the later Pius XII, from being sent to the front because they were eligible, they were of military age. They had to make exceptions for them.
Did Italy have an influence on the Vatican at the time? Because it was a difficult situation, was it?
It was a very difficult situation. But the real problem was that the Italians were paranoid about the Vatican being able to use the war and above all use the eventual peace conference to get back their territories in central Rome. In other words, to resolve the Roman question to the disadvantage of the Italians. And therefore, when the Italians entered the war in 1915, they inserted a clause into the treaty with Britain, France and Russia, which said that the Pope would not be allowed to be represented at a peace conference.
And you were listening there to historian John Pollard, whose book, Benedict XV, The Unknown Pope, was the first such biography in English in over 40 years. Our thanks go to him. And that's all I have time for on today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, I'll be back again at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join me then. Laudetur Jesus Christus.